The CDC is now recommending a fourth Pfizer and Moderna COVID vaccine shot for people over the age of 50 and for some people with compromised immune systems after yesterday's FDA authorization. The recommendation comes after researchers found waning immunity in those who got the COVID booster more than 4 months ago. U.S. health officials say the benefit of a second booster outweighs any risk, but some people have yet to even get a first shot of the vaccine, including some vaccine skeptics who do not believe the science that shows the shot to be safe and effective. Vaccine skepticism is nothing new. In fact, it's been around since the earliest experiments into vaccines. From the podcast Endless Thread, producers Ben Brock Johnson and Amory Sievertson have this injection of history.
It's the year 1721 in Boston, and things are not great. A smallpox outbreak arrives from the Caribbean via passengers on a ship called the HMS Seahorse. Over half the entire city is hit with the virus. People are dying left and right.
If you've never seen smallpox, it kind of looks like your skin has been turned into bubble wrap.
Ugh.
You have thousands and thousands of these painful-looking pustules. It sounds like a nightmare.
I think it was a nightmare, and you don't have to take our word for it.
When smallpox broke out, there was widespread panic.
Gareth Williams is a professor emeritus of medicine at the University of Bristol in the UK, and he wrote the book The Angel of Death, The Story of Smallpox.
And 90% of its victims were kids under the age of five, so it had a great reputation as being the slayer of innocents. And if you got it and you lived, you weren't necessarily that lucky, because about a third of the survivors were badly scarred, and they could be hideously disfigured. There are plenty of cases on record of people who survived smallpox and then killed themselves because they couldn't bear to look in the mirror.
When it came around, and it did every few years, sometimes through trade routes, smallpox could infect 60% of a population, and a third of those people might straight up die. So Cotton Mather is a minister in a predominantly Puritan Boston, and in his world, this is just like a regularly occurring horrible thing that happens every few years. And in his particular group of Christians, everyone believes it's just God's will.
There used to be a time when we got infectious diseases, and there was nothing we could do other than just kind of live through them or die.
Renee Nahara is an epidemiologist and the editor of The History of Vaccines, a website studying the global history of vaccination. He knows a ton about the story of terrible diseases and how humanity has figured out ways to fight them.
Renee knows that whatever time period you are talking about, how humanity usually fights disease is with a mix of folklore, faith, and hopefully a good bit of scientific knowledge. Cotton Mather is no exception.
And maybe more importantly, Mather is spending a lot of time around an enslaved person who knows something that he doesn't.
He owned a slave from Africa whose name I always slaughter to. It's Onesimus, O-N-E-S-I-M-U-S.
This wasn't his real name, by the way. It's just a biblical name that Mather called him. It means useful.
And the slave had a mark on his arm, and Mr. Mather said, you know, what is that mark? And Onesimus said, they gave us the smallpox so we wouldn't get the smallpox. And that was very interesting to him. He's like, what are you talking about?
Mather says, I gotta look into this. So he sends out letters all over the world to all of his fellow scholars of European descent, of course. He's like, is this a thing? And they say,
Yep.
The letters come back and people in Turkey say, oh yeah, I've heard about this. The Arabs do it all the time. They take a lancet and they lance the pus out of somebody with smallpox, and they insert that lancet into somebody's arm or somebody's hand. And then those people, if they get a fever, they do get a little bit sick. But if they don't, if they don't die from full-blown smallpox, they become immune.
It's a pretty wild idea. And, as it turns out, an ancient one, discovered and practiced in a lot of different cultures, taking smallpox scabs or pus and introducing the virus to the body to protect people from getting the full-blown disease.
So how did this practice start? Here's how Renee Nahara thinks it might have gone down. In 10th century China, in the Gobi Desert.
My personal guess is that somebody died of smallpox. Somebody came upon their body, and the body was desiccated, and they breathed in the dust from the body. And then that person went into some place where there was massive amounts of smallpox. They didn't get sick. And they themselves said, I wonder if it was because I was somehow protected by the spirit, the dust, the whatever came off of that body who had smallpox.
So it makes sense that this person in the Gobi Desert, who maybe inhaled some dead guy pixie dust and lived to tell the tale through a smallpox outbreak, might lead other people to say, we got to get us some dead guy pixie dust.
Which led to the ancient Chinese practice of drying out smallpox scabs, grinding them up, and blowing them up each other's noses with straws.
Much like cocaine, I guess, without the euphoria.
This is one form of something called inoculation by variolation. It's an early way to make people immune to disease. Now, fast forward several centuries.
And we're back at Cotton Mather's house in Boston. And he's reading these letters that have come in from all over the world, full of wild stories.
There was a lady in England called Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who had seen this practice being performed in Constantinople. Her husband was the ambassador to Turkey, to the Ottoman Empire. And she saw this being done to members of the diplomatic corps. They had sort of smallpox variolation parties with a little old Turkish lady turning up with half a walnut shell containing smallpox pus. And she would dip a needle into that and scratch it into the arms of the kids. And Lady Mary was so smitten with this that she actually got her own son variolated.
So Mather takes all of this information and he's like, all right, let's do this. Let's start getting rid of smallpox in Boston with variolation, the predecessor to vaccination. Mather finds one physician, Zabdiel Boylston, who's willing to try this risky experiment.
Not a lot of volunteers come in right out of the gate. So they do it to enslaved people who haven't already been variolated back in Africa, and also their own children, some of whom are toddlers. Problematic for sure. Pretty soon, though, an even bigger problem pops up for Boylston and Mather's operation. The people they are enslaving and their own kids don't have a choice. But the other Puritans in Mather's community, even in his own congregation, are like, wait a minute, your slave told you about this?
Also, this smallpox outbreak is God's will, you know that. And you want to do what with old scabs and smallpox pustules?
Religious authorities got in on it as well, for the same reasons of maintaining body purity, that the body was pure the way it was designed, and why should we mess with something that's natural?
So, take blatant racism, add in some squeamishness around scabs, stir in some puritanical beliefs. What do you get? You get the Society of Physicians Anti-Inoculators, led by the only person in the city of Boston who's technically an MD at the time.
11,000 people, only one real doctor.
William Douglas was the doctor's name, and Douglas starts this group. They meet in coffee shops around the city. They become very vocal.
Eventually, someone throws a bomb into Mather's house, which lands in a room where his nephew is recovering from variolation. The firebomb thrown into Mather's house malfunctioned. It never exploded. And despite the best efforts of the Society of Physicians Anti-Inoculators, Mather and Boylston's experiment becomes the first ever numbers-supported clinical trial in Western medical history, which is standard procedure now.
They're tallying up the people they save, the people they unintentionally kill, and the other people in the city who get smallpox and live or die. And then finally, Mather decides to send all of this information to the big boss.
He sends it off to the Queen of England, saying, here's our report from your colonies, Your Majesty. This is what we did. And look, like, not a lot of people got smallpox, actually, you know, who were inoculated, variolated. And the British government then says, all right, everybody, all the colonies, now everybody's going to get this variolation.
A mandatory policy from the crown to the colonies. This doesn't go over great in pre-Revolutionary War Boston. I don't know why. I mean,
who'd have thunk it? And while Renee says there are other examples of resistance to variolation, this is kind of a crucial plot point in the story of vaccination. Because in some ways, you see the roots of two familiar ideas.
Well, number one, the government is not going to tell me what to do with my own body. And number two, you know, discrediting the science and saying, no, there's no evidence for this. You know, he got the idea from a slave. What do they know? He got the idea from the Arabs in Turkey. What do they know?
Skepticism of authority, xenophobia, racism, all still big issues in America 300 years later. And two ideas, freedom to choose, questions about the validity of the science of vaccines, both of these are still present and powerful in today's debates about vaccination.
Ben Brock Johnson and Amory Sievertson are co-hosts of the podcast Endless Thread.